Welcome to the Federal Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federal Society's Litigation Practice Group, was recorded on Monday, January 25th, 2016, during a live telephone conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members. Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group telephone conference call, as today we'll be discussing the False Claims Act. I'm Dean Reuter, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. Please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call. Also, we're recording this call for use as a podcast in the future. We're very pleased to welcome to our show today Stephen J. Obermeyer. He's a partner at Wiley Rhine, and Shane B. Kelly, an associate at Wiley Rhine. They're going to have some opening remarks, some back-and-forth discussion between the two of them, 20, 25 minutes, perhaps 30 minutes. But as always, we'll be turning to the audience for questions on this snow day here in Washington, D.C. So please do be thinking of those questions in advance. Mr. Obermeyer and Mr. Kelly were very gracious to join us on a day when it's very difficult to get around here in Washington, D.C. So with that, gentlemen, the floor is yours.
Hi, everyone. This is Steve Obermeyer. Thanks again for joining us on this snow day. I, for one, am stuck in my house doing this with no plowing in my neighborhood, but we're going to go on anyway here. So today we're going to be discussing not just the False Claims Act generally, but the Escobar case that is currently pending before the Supreme Court and its implications for False Claims Act jurisprudence. Just generally, this is a big case. It's going to define the scope of what constitutes fraud under a very important statute that imposes very severe consequences on defendants with a treble damages provision. False Claims Act recoveries are in several billions of dollars each year, so it's a major statute. And it's particularly a big case in the government contract and healthcare worlds, as all False Claims Act cases are, where you have companies that are constantly interacting with the government and working to navigate kind of complex contractual requirements as well as regulatory schemes. Just as a little update on where the case is, the petitioner just filed its brief, Universal Health Services, this past Tuesday. And so you're going to have a opposition brief in about 30 days and then a reply brief about 30 days after that. And then we expect a decision this term. Just a brief roadmap as to how Shane and I are going to go through this. Shane's going to start by giving you kind of a brief summary of the False Claims Act, very brief, just to, for those of you who aren't as familiar with it. And then we're going to go through an explanation of the issue in Escobar, which is the so-called implied certification theory of liability. And in the course of doing that, we'll discuss the facts in Escobar as well as some of the cases that make up the circuit split at issue here. And then Shane and I will give you some thoughts on the merits of the arguments and which way the court might go, and then the implications for a ruling pretty much either way. So with that, I'll turn it over to Shane to talk a little bit about the False Claims Act generally.
All right, thanks, Steve. Yeah, so the False Claims Act, just to give a little bit of background knowledge as we discuss these issues. So the False Claims Act is the general civil fraud statute for the federal government. And it excludes tax issues, so it doesn't cover tax fraud, but pretty much any other context in which someone is doing business with the government and receives money, that is what is covered by the False Claims Act. And it has some unique provisions in that it allows private parties to sue in the name of the federal government, and then if successful, they can receive a portion of the recovery, and that, those people are called key TAM relators, and it basically allows private people to whistleblow on fraud that they see and get a financial incentive for doing that. And the law creates treble damages for any false claims submitted to the government and civil penalties between $5,000 and $10,000. So it can be quite significant depending on how many claims are at issue and what the facts are. And the elements of a False Claims Act violation are knowing submission of a false or fraudulent claim or a false record or statement material to a false or fraudulent claim. And so there are a few different parts to that. First, it involves a false or fraudulent claim, and there is no statutory definition of what constitutes a false or fraudulent claim to the government. And that's actually where the issue in Escobar falls. So the question in Escobar is, you know, what does false or fraudulent mean under the statute? With regard to claim, it's very broad, and it really means any request or demand for payment under a contract or otherwise for money or property from the United States or someone who's using United States money. So, for example, the states under the Medicaid program, a false claim to, you know, a state Medicaid program still falls under the Federal False Claims Act because there's a portion of United States money. And so false claims submitted to the government have to be submitted knowingly, which is the scienter requirement for the statute. And there's a statutory definition that says this means actual knowledge. So, you know this is a false claim, but you're submitting it to the government anyway. But it also means deliberate ignorance of the truth or falsity of the information submitted, or reckless disregard for the truth or falsity of the information submitted. So it includes, what some courts have called, gross negligence plus. So, if you're really not doing what you're supposed to be doing in ensuring the accuracy of the claims for payment you're submitting to the government, that can still be a violation of the False Claims Act, even though you may not have had actual knowledge that it was a false claim. And finally, sometimes FCA violations require that the false statement or record be material to the claim for payment. And that also has a specific statutory definition. It says having a natural tendency to influence or be capable of influencing the payment or receipt of money or property. So it doesn't mean something is, substantial or important, but really, could it influence the government's decision to pay, in any circumstance? And it's more of an objective standard. So it's a very, very low bar. And so these are generally how courts, lay out the elements of an FCA violation, but they're often interrelated, and scienter and materiality are often implicated in trying to understand whether something is false, because, if you know you're doing something that you shouldn't be doing and it's important to the claim for payment, some courts will then consider the claim for payment false, even though it's kind of dependent on the other prongs, and we'll discuss how that plays out in Escobar a little bit.
And this is Steve, and like Shane previewed, the Escobar case is really about the false or fraudulent prong, notwithstanding how the other elements of the False Claims Act offense kind of tend to bleed into this. But as the name of the statute suggests, and as that element suggests, the typical False Claims Act case involves an objectively false statement. And these have tended to be two different types. There's the false factual statement. And the standard example of that would be submission of inflated hours by a government contractor. So, the contractor submits an invoice for 100 hours of work and the employee has only worked 50 hours. The other kind of standard false statement is the false express certification. And that's when, again, I'll use a contractor as an example. Contractor submits an invoice, and on that invoice it says, with the submission of this claim, I hereby certify that there were no conflicts of interest when this payment for a request was made. And in fact, there were conflicts of interest. So that's typically how false statements have been understood in the False Claims Act case. But the idea of a false statement kind of expanded with the advent of the so-called implied certifications, which are what is at issue in Escobar. The idea of an implied certification is that regardless of the existence of an explicit false statement, a defendant could be held liable under the False Claims Act for knowingly violating a contract provision or legal requirement. So basically what it says is a contractor, for instance, would be impliedly certifying, that is, complying with relevant laws and contractual provisions whenever submitting a claim for payment. An example is a case from a while back, the Abtec case in the Court of Federal Claims. A small business was held liable for a False Claims Act violation for knowingly violating the Section 8 small business rules while submitting claims for payment under a Section 8 contract, even though at no point did they certify expressly that they were complying with those Section 8 rules. And the implied certification theory kind of relates to a broader idea of the False Claims Act, that it really is a statute that should encompass pretty much all situations in which someone obtains money from the government to which they are not entitled. And that kind of broader idea has been referenced in the case law and in the legislative history of the statute, and has been that legislative history has been cited for that proposition. I'm going to turn over to Shane to talk a little bit about how the circuit split has developed on the issue.
Yeah, thanks, Steve. So the implied certification theory has led to really two circuit splits, which is kind of the reason that the court probably stepped in here, because it was creating a pretty clear divide. So first, there's a circuit split with regard to whether or not implied certification is a valid theory of liability under the False Claims Act at all. And then second, there's a split about how it should be applied and under what circumstances, you know, just submitting a claim for payment is implying compliance with the relevant contractual and legal obligations. So most circuits do recognize implied certification in some form. And so this includes the First, Second, Third, Fourth, Sixth, Ninth, Tenth, and Eleventh circuits. And the Fifth and Seventh circuits are the two that have said explicitly that they do not recognize this and are not going to apply it as a theory of FCA liability. And the Seventh Circuit said this in a more clear way in a recent case called Sanford Brown that was decided just earlier in 2015. So in that case, the allegations surrounded a for-profit school called Sanford Brown College. And in order to be eligible for education subsidies and, you know, federal loans for their students and things like that, they had to enter into what's called a program participation agreement with the Department of Education. And in the program participation agreement, they agreed to abide by a broad range of federal statutes, including Title IV of the Higher Education Act, which prohibits certain behaviors in student admissions and recruitment. So you can't, under Title IV of the Higher Education Act, you can't give commissions to admissions officers or staff, because the worry is that then they're just going to try and get people through the door who aren't appropriate, not really getting anything out of the education. So as a part of the program participation agreement, this school agreed to abide by those restrictions. And then a QTAM later, a former employee, alleged that the college was violating lots of these rules. And he argued that, therefore, they were not entitled to the education subsidies that the school was receiving, which would render the claims for those subsidies false under the False Claims Act. And so the unanimous panel from the Seventh Circuit rejected this theory and said that it was inappropriate to consider, you know, the claims for subsidies themselves as implied representations that they were complying with this huge range of statutory requirements. You know, the court said it would be thousands and thousands of pages if you followed every statute referenced in the program participation agreement, and that there's really no limiting principle to the false implied certification theory. If you consider, you know, each claim for payment a representation that you're complying with all these laws. So that was part of the impetus for Escobar being accepted by the court, because there was a very clear rejection of the theory applied by most circuit courts. The Escobar case actually came out of the First Circuit, and in that case, the QTAM relators filed a complaint alleging that a mental health clinic in Massachusetts was operating and submitting claims for payment under Medicaid with staff who were not qualified and were not being supervised in accordance with Massachusetts regulations. So the relators were actually parents of a teenager who was receiving care at this clinic and then died as a result of medications she was given by someone who was not a psychologist and was not being supervised properly. And the parents did some investigation and eventually filed a False Claims Act suit, saying that all of the claims for payment under Medicaid that were submitted were false because the clinic was not operating in accordance with the required regulations. The problem was that the clinic had never certified to the federal government or represented to the federal government that they were complying with these regulations. So there was no real specific misstatement in connection with the Medicaid payments. Here, the First Circuit found that the relators did state a claim under the False Claims Act. They rejected the label of implied certification, but they basically said, you know, express or implied, it doesn't matter. As long as someone is submitting a claim for payment, they are implicitly communicating that they conformed to the relevant program requirements. So they basically said, yes, this states a claim under the False Claims Act in direct opposition to the Sanford Brown case in the Seventh Circuit.
In this, Steve, and so Shane just described there the split with respect to whether implied certification is even a viable theory under the statute. The other kind of secondary circuit split at issue in Escobar is how, assuming there is an applied certification theory, how is that theory applied? This is a little hard to explain, so I'll do my best. Basically, all of the circuits that have accepted an implied certification theory have said that the violation of a legal or contractual duty must be a prerequisite to payment or a quote-unquote condition of payment, as opposed to a quote-unquote condition of participation in the government program. What it really boils down to is, you know, the prerequisites needed to enter into a contract or to be in a program, a violation of that is not going to be the basis for a False Claims Act liability. There has to be some kind of prerequisite to payment of a specific claim in order to have False Claims Act liability. Where the split comes up is the question is, does the condition of payment have to be expressly identified in the regulations or contract, or does the condition of payment just need to be somehow material to payment? So if you think of the expressly identified condition would be the idea of, say, a regulation says, to get paid, you must do X, and expressly says that. And the Second and Sixth Circuits have said, yes, this is the kind of language you would need in order to make an implied certification claim, and you'd have to plead that in the complaint. The other way to look at it would be to say, does the condition, whether the condition is material to payment, and so that would be more along the lines of, okay, the regulation says you must do X, is X material to payment, whether or not it expressly says it's required for payment, and the First, Fourth, and D.C. circuits have all accepted this material to payment requirement.
Yeah, this is Shane, and so both of those issues, whether or not implied certification is a valid theory at all and how it should be applied, are actually raised by the Escobar case. The full name of it is Universal Health Services v. United States, ex rel. Escobar. And the Supreme Court granted certiorari on two questions. First, is the implied certification test for determining when claims have sufficiently pled falsity for the purposes of the False Claims Act valid? So is, you know, implied certification a valid theory of the False Claims Act? And if so, does the relevant statute need to explicitly state the conditions of payment with which the defendant allegedly failed to comply? And so those are the issues that the Supreme Court is going to be hearing.
And this is Steve. And so that kind of gives you some background on how we got to the point, how the court got to the point of deciding the Escobar decision. And that brings us to, you know, Shane and I will offer some thoughts now about how we think the Supreme Court decision is going to go. And I have to say, start off the bat, this is a pretty tough call. It's not a really obviously ideological area of the law. The fault lines aren't maybe as obvious and as easy to predict as in some other types of cases. You know, one interesting thing, at least with respect to the first question, whether or not there even is an implied certification theory viable in the statute, is that, you know, a lot of the circuits have adopted this. And if you look at the decisions and pretty much all of the main circuit decisions, there are no dissents. So there, or I should say few that I can think of. So there really is a lot of momentum for recognition of the implied certification theory. With that said, you know, a textual statutory approach to the False Claims Act, I think it's tough to get to an implied certification theory. You know, I think the idea would be that the phrase false and fraudulent would be broad enough to encompass these kind of implied certifications. And I think that's actually kind of a tough argument to make. But even with a seemingly weaker basis for a textualist approach, you have some people who or some judges who you wouldn't think of as being for a non-textualist approach who have adopted this theory. And the example I think of right away is the SAIC decision in the D.C. Circuit. It was a decision by Judge Tatel. This is when the D.C. Circuit adopted an implied certification theory, and then they adopted a no express condition of payment requirement. Judge Sentell, someone who is not afraid to write separately and you know, as we all know, was a pretty hardcore textualist judge, signed on to the opinion. So I thought that was pretty interesting and might make some a little bit more unclear how the textualist might go on this statute, the textualist on the court, that is. And then going the other way, though, the court, the Supreme Court, that is, has been hesitant recently to expand the False Claims Act too far. An example is just some language from the Allison Engine case. Justice Alito, on behalf of a unanimous court, warned against, quote, expanding the FCA well beyond its intended role. And arguably going into an implied certification theory does just that. And really it comes down to weighing two kind of tensions. One is, you know, an implied certification theory on some level runs the risk of making every contract or regulatory violation and turning it into a fraud case with treble damages. And, you know, Sanford Brown mentions that the lack of a limiting principle, and I think that's a real fear. I, for instance, just recently had a case in the Eastern District of Virginia, defended a small government contracting company that was facing a complaint with about 50 minor, maybe even more than that, violations of a very complex contract. And the relator just said, yeah, well, there was an implied certification, so it's a False Claims Act case. Government did not intervene. Case, you know, at first blush seemed frivolous, seemed like an obvious contract case, but case went up to summary judgment and right on the brink of trial. So, you know, the existence of an implied certification theory creates that possibility. I just referenced this case in the Fourth Circuit. There's the Wilson case. This is from several years ago, I think 2008. Judge Wilkinson said, you know, warned against making every contract violation, a False Claims Act case, but you know, in Triple Canopy, which was the Fourth Circuit's adoption of implied certification, you know, they paid lip service to that, but ultimately they adopted the implied certification theory and didn't provide an obvious limiting principle. So that's one of the tensions that the Supreme Court is going to have to weigh.
Yeah, I think another one, Steve, is so the other side of that is the court does not want to make the False Claims Act a rigid system that fails to encompass what really looks like fraud against the government. So the facts in Escobar seem pretty terrible on first blush. You know, a teenager died because someone misrepresented their, you know, medical qualifications, really. And, you know, that clinic was getting full reimbursement for Medicaid while providing extremely substandard care and violating, you know, their legal obligations. So to say that shouldn't be a False Claims Act case is a little bit questionable, maybe. The Triple Canopy case you mentioned from the Fourth Circuit, I think, is another one where the facts really feel like they should fall within the False Claims Act, even though there was no express certification and no, you know, factual falsity. Just to give a little background about that case, a company provided guards to bases in Iraq. And as a part of the contract, there was a requirement that the guards had to pass marksmanship tests. So they had to meet, you know, Army requirements for marksmanship. Well, the guards couldn't. And so the managers basically just forged their results and put them in their HR files. So there, you know, the federal government was paying for guards and they couldn't shoot. And, you know, the contractor knew that and they just didn't disclose it while still billing full freight on the contract. And that was the case that the Fourth Circuit said, yes, this should be within the False Claims Act. So you have to have some flexibility to encompass situations that are fraud against the government, but without making it every breach of contract.
And this is Steve, and I guess certainly those are important considerations, and that's what makes this a tough test. But, you know, is that idea supported in the statute? And certainly the facts in Escobar are terrible, but you know, those bad facts shouldn't render an expansion of the statute beyond what it provides for. And you know, at least one commentator, I mentioned a little bit about the lack of an obvious textual basis for implied certification. But one commentator, Basie, who's kind of well known in the False Claims Act area, points out kind of a logical leap with the implied certification theory, which is that, you know, it basically eliminates the government's burden of proving that the defendant knowingly submitted a false claim. and instead it allows the government to base liability on a defendant falsely implying that it never fell out of compliance with the contractual regulatory requirements. In other words, rather than having the burden on the government to or the relator to establish that the defendant submitted a false claim for payment, it becomes more of an ongoing obligation of the defendant to keep complying with the regulations and contracts, and if they fall out of compliance, they're subject to False Claims Act violations. Which strikes me as a problem, but I'm not sure Shane is buying that logic quite as much.
Yeah, I don't know about that. So I think that, I think basically the entire theory is that a claim you submit where you know you're not doing the things that would entitle you to payment is itself a false claim. So, if you can show, violation of really significant contract or regulatory obligations, you don't necessarily need to show there's something false about the claim itself, but clearly in the context it is a false claim. But I guess that's the dispute the court has to piece through.
Well, one of the things to consider too there is why isn't the agency itself regulating violations of its own regulations and its own contracts? A lot of these regulatory regimes, and if you look even at the Escobar case, I understand the penalties weren't severe, but there were regulatory penalties for the defendants failing to have certified people do the mental health care in that case. When there's not an obvious false claims that brings under the statute, it seems that the regulator can handle those violations outside of a fraud and treble damages context. Of course, the response to that ends up being, regulatory capture is always a problem. And really, it's the whistleblower aspect of the False Claims Act case that brings a lot of these issues to the fore, and the fact that a relator is eligible to get a portion of the recovery. And it's one of the strongest aspects of the False Claims Act. So that's an issue as well.
Yeah, this is Shane. And I think what might make the most sense as a resolution to this issue would be to create a materiality standard that lets courts sort out what's a really important violation of a legal or contractual requirement. So, providing guards that can't shoot versus something that's very unimportant and really doesn't rob the government of the benefit of its bargain. And I think the facts in Sanford Brown and Seventh Circuit really fall in that category where, paying your admissions officers in the wrong way doesn't rob, students of the education and the social benefits of having greater education. The problem with that is in the most recent amendment to the False Claims Act, I think in 2009 or 2010, Congress defined the term material as having a natural tendency to influence or being capable of influencing the payment or receipt of money, as I said earlier. So they statutorily define material as such a low bar that really doesn't filter out, appropriate implied certifications from inappropriate ones.
And certainly the D.C. This is Steve. And certainly the D.C. Circuit and the Fourth Circuit were depending on materiality being a limiting principle, and also Siena being a limiting principle. I think there are probably some good arguments that the Siena in particular is going to limit some things. If you have a reasonable interpretation of a regulation or a contract provision, that should negate Siena, possibly even as a matter of law. There's some case law support that, like the Supreme Court Safeco decision, which was, I believe, Fair Credit Reporting Act, not a False Claims Act case. But the idea being that Siena and materiality are going to ultimately limit any complete, blowing up of the False Claims Act into a much broader statute. But the problem with this is, how is it consistent with the statute to read Siena and materiality into the falsity requirement? I mean, they're separate elements. And again, going back to what Basie said, the government has the burden of proving a false claim, and that burden should not be reduced because, we can just hope on that the materiality and Siena prongs are going to catch the frivolous cases. And the problem with that approach also is it's really difficult to deal with those issues on the pleadings. You're going to need discovery most likely for Siena and materiality and maybe even a trial, particularly with Siena. So, it really substantially raises the costs to defending these cases. And again, the case I was telling you about that I had recently kind of is an example of that. The case had to go past the motion dismiss stage in order to demonstrate the lack of scienter and other issues with the claims made. So where does that leave us in the Supreme Court? We kind of went back and forth there. You know, hard to say. I guess I think that the momentum, again, is going towards an implied certification theory. I think you're probably going to have a split of some sort in favor of that. But I would also say that the second issue, which we've talked less about, which is how the implied certification theory is applied, I think the express condition of payment would hopefully at least be something the court would be willing to adopt to ensure that there is some kind of a limiting principle. You know, if the government or the relator is required to plead the existence of an express condition of payment, that certainly alleviates some of the problems I was just discussing about the case being kicked down all the way towards to trial before a decision's made.
Yeah, this is Shane. I think I think that would be a good resolution and would make sense as a limiting principle. I think in the longer term, I think that still has a lot of risks because it would be very easy for agencies to start, you know, dumping really broad requirements into a list of conditions of payment in order to, you know, ratchet up the cost of noncompliance. So, you know, they could, you know, put, you know, just a heading, you know, these are the conditions of payment, and then, you know, list tons of really broad contract requirements and statutory requirements, and then you're back in the same situation where, you know, there's really not much of a limiting principle in determining what's an implied certification and what's not.
And this is Steve, and I'll just quickly, because we're coming up on a little, about 30 minutes we've been talking here, we're getting ready to take some questions, but, you know, what are the implications depending on how the court rules? You know, Escobar really, depending on how it comes out, could, you know, greatly expand or contract in a lot of circuits False Claims Act liability for those doing business with the government. And it really comes down to this risk of, does implied certification, does that theory risk making every contract claim, every regulatory violation, a treble damages, potentially bet the company kind of case, no matter how insignificant the violations are? Again, the proponents will say, don't worry, materiality and scienter will limit it. But this is the last point I'll kind of leave it on. It's not just about winning, at least from the defendant's standpoint. You know, allowing this theory at all encourages the kind of questionable claims that are difficult to decide on a motion to dismiss. And I think the concern is probably most acute with the key TAM relators. And again, you know, the key TAM relators, the government doesn't have to intervene for these cases to move forward. And now the DOJ certainly can dismiss a frivolous key TAM case, but I can see from experience that they pretty much never do. So you have this risk of the key TAM relators going forward with these and trying to push a settlement. And even not just the key TAM relators, I mean, DOJ has fought hard for this theory, and you can even see that they filed an amicus brief in Sanford Brown. But what all this does is it really puts on pressure for defendants to settle. The stakes are high. The dollar values get high very fast when you're trebling damages in these big federal contracts. Not to mention, you know, just the risk of debarment in a federal contract case could be an enormous consequence of these cases. And just the accusations of fraud. I mean, it's bad for a company's reputation and could hurt business. So, you know, the case, like I said, just to sum up, a lot riding on this. Be very interesting to see where it goes. And hopefully the court will, if they do adopt this principle, will be clear about the limiting principles that can ensure that this kind of parade of horribles that I just described doesn't end up being the case, particularly for government contractors and healthcare companies. And with that, Dean, I guess I'll turn it over to you.
Well, thank you both, gentlemen, very much. In a moment, let's open it up for questions. In a moment, we'll all hear an announcement that will say the floor mode is on. After you hear that announcement, if you have a question, just push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. So once again, if you have a question for either of our experts, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. We'll take the questions as they're received. We've got about 25 minutes remaining in our program and quite a few callers. Before we go to our first question, though, let me talk about our upcoming schedule of conference calls. Tomorrow, let's see, I'm looking on our website as I speak. at 1 o'clock, we'll be talking about telecom transactions. That's tomorrow at 1 o'clock. And then Wednesday at 2 p.m., we'll be talking about corporate inversions, as I read today on the Internet, as Tyco International and Johnson Controls plan their merger, which will result in, I guess, combined total of $32 billion in revenue. So corporate inversions on Wednesday, tomorrow, telecom transactions at 1. Today, of course, we're talking about the False Claims Act with two of our experts. If you'd like to ask a question, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. We've got two questions pending, so let's take the first call of the day.
Hi, can you hear me?
Yeah, we can hear you. Go ahead, caller.
Sure. This is Trey Mayfield. I'm actually lead counsel in the Triple Canopy Botter case for Mr. Botter. So I found the commentary interesting. I'm curious what this, given the at least the view of one of our speakers, that this is a textual matter that settles itself, how you distinguish then between the separate terms false and fraudulent. I could understand your claim that a false claim must be explicit if it just said false claim, but the subsequent term fraudulent seems to denote something different, and that's pretty consistent in statutory interpretation whenever the term fraud is used, something that is misleading in and of itself without necessarily being expressly false.
Thanks. I guess a question from a real expert on this as well, and also I think a difficult question. The textual basis for this is going to come out of the false or fraudulent language and the fraudulent language. I guess my issue with the fraudulent language is it becomes very hard to give meaning to that term independent from the term false, if that makes sense. So it begins to encompass a ton of behavior, and I guess this is some of the stuff that I was describing that is really expands and makes it difficult for, at least from the defendant side, to figure out what is it that's going to make me eligible for this, and also at what point does the behavior involve such small violations of a contract, such small regulatory violations that, again, subjects you to what is really a very serious allegation of fraud and potentially very serious penalties. So I don't know if I'm answering your question specifically. I think that's the $64 million question from a textualist approach. I know, there's also some what's interesting when I'm reading this, and I'd be curious what you've seen as well, but other than a reference to the word fraudulent, there's not much in the way of supporting what then limits the idea of what's fraudulent behavior covered by this. So I think reading it in combination with the word false and its kind of traditional understanding of requiring a false statement is where what the statute is requiring. Shane, I don't know if you have any thoughts on that as well.
Yeah, so I think there definitely is a lot of room for the court to use that word, false or fraudulent, to craft some sort of contour for the implied certification theory. I think most courts haven't latched on to that to say anything, that's deceptive or misleading in submitting a claim can be a violation of the False Claims Act, just because that seems a little too far outside of the scope of the statute. But at the same time, there's not Supreme Court precedent, specifically defining that phrase or how it may operate. And so I think, in your case, in the Triple Canopy case, depending on how they rule in Escobar, they could say that, something can be fraudulently misleading, by an omission. And therefore, that's within the False Claims Act. But I think you still run into that problem that Steve mentioned, where the boundaries are just very unclear. And to say to every government contractor and every healthcare provider, don't do anything that's deceptive or misleading when you're submitting a claim is just a very, very difficult, impossible to apply standard. So I think there's room for that textually, but I don't know that the court will go that direction.
I wonder, before we move on, we've got one question pending. Does the caller have a follow-up question?
No, I appreciate your answer. I think sort of my view of all this, for what it's worth, is I think the concerns that you've expressed are quite real, but what we have going on is courts that have created a, if you will, a by judicial fiat, an amendment to the statute. I mean, you're right. It may be very unsatisfying when you're the defense counsel to rely on a materiality and scienter requirement, but nowhere in the False Claims Act does it say that all claims should be resolved or most claims should be resolved at the dismissal stage. It seems to me that if that's the problem, the resolution is to go to Congress, not to create a judicial overlay with this implied certification argument. And that's why I think there's so much disparity among the courts, is because, frankly, it doesn't really have any basis in the language or the structure of the statute. It's simply judicial gatekeeping, as if you had a new Rule 54 standard for False Claims Act cases. That doesn't create much direction, but I don't think it's statutorily created. I think it's just a judicial reaction to prevent a deluge.
This is Steve, and I think that's a really fair and important point. And it's something that, you know, if the court comes in and says there is no implied certification, nothing is stopping Congress from somehow defining the contours of this and making this better. And in some ways, that might be the best approach. The other thing is, you know, Triple Canopy, as you know very well, is one of those cases where, and I think Shane mentioned this, but it just seems like it should be a fraud case on some level. I mean, you've got allegations of false statements of marksmanship being submitted in these files, and it just does not, my understanding of the case is it was always been a little bit of trying to fit a square peg into a round hole. And so the court came up and finally adopted, that is the Fourth Circuit, finally adopted an implied certification theory to make that square peg fit in the round hole. And but in terms of its textual basis, it's tough. It's tough.
Yeah, and I think it's also easily possible that, you know, if Congress is dissatisfied with how this case is resolved, that they would create some kind of amendment. The Allison Engine case in the late 2000s was a clear example of that, where the court read, you know, the statute kind of restrictively, and Congress wasn't happy about that, so they quickly passed something and tried, you know, made it retroactive in some respects. And so I think if there are cases that are precluded by the court's ruling in this case, then I think it'd be very likely that you'd see a pretty quick response from Congress.
Yeah, I think that's right. Just for a very quick note to bolster your opinion, in our oral argument, one of the Fourth Circuit judges yelled at the counsel for Triple Canopy, "Counsel, you've heard the old adage about how bad fake facts make bad law. Well, we're about to make some bad law."
Yeah. And Escobar's even worse on the facts. So.
Well, this is Dean again. Again, if to our audience, if you have a question, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. We've got just one question pending, then our lines will be wide open. But for now, let's take another call.
Yes, I had two questions, and that is the first one is I am assuming that the Escobar case would, whatever the decision is, would also apply. I forget the legal term, but it's it's called, I think, a reverse False Claims Act. It's where, like in the federal royalty context, where companies can be liable under the False Claims Act if they submit royalties incorrectly. Would this case also apply in that situation where the defendant owes fees or royalties to the government?
That's a good question. I actually, you know, I was thinking about that, and I'm not really sure specifically, but what I will say is that in the Reverse False Claims Act, which is, Section A1G of the statute, it actually has broader language in terms of what would constitute the kind of fraudulent behavior that would be eligible for recovery. And I'm looking at the language here. Sorry, you just give me one second.
Sure.
Because basically you could – it talks about knowingly concealing or knowingly and improperly avoiding or decreasing an obligation to pay or transmit money or property to the government. It doesn't have the same kind of specific claim language. It's actually broader in that kind of any improper behavior, at least it seems to say that could result in an underpayment to the government is going to qualify under the Reverse False Claims Act. I've had a case that has involved this as well, and, you know, we've looked into it some, and some courts have definitely said, and I'm not going to remember them off the top of my head, I apologize, I think it's mostly district courts have said, look, I mean, if you don't need kind of the specific false statement like you do in a regular False Claims Act case, in a Reverse False Claims Act case, just kind of improper behavior that leads to an underpayment is enough to state a claim. I, to be honest, don't know what DOJ's position is on that. I know this is something that hasn't been addressed a lot, but it's kind of a, you know, kind of an interesting quirk in the statute that it would be a little bit less of a hurdle in the Reverse False Claims Act situation than the regular False Claims Act, at least as we've been talking about it. Does that make sense?
Yes, yes. I was not aware that there was a different legal standard in the Reverse False Claims Act arena. That's very interesting. As you know, they've become a lot more aggressive against the energy industry on royalty issues. The other question I had is, in the regular False Claims Act situation, if the court were to reject the implied certification theory, I mean, isn't this easily enough solved by, you know, I can think of the context in certain filings under the SEC or the EPA where the highest level individual basically has to sign off that everything they've done is legal. I mean, couldn't the government just easily require as a condition for payment by the government just a very broad-based certification when you submit the paperwork that you have complied with every jot and tittle of every applicable statute and regulation?
This is Steve. It sure seems like it. It sure seems like it would be easier, and you certainly see invoices that have a certification just like that, and I have often wondered why they don't turn up in more invoices. I guess I don't know the answer why. But I would agree with you if that certification is in there, you know, by signing this, I hereby certify that I've complied with all, you know, laws, regulations, statutes, and policies relevant to the whatever act I'm submitting this under. You know, that would be a way to get past this barrier. And, you know, it's interesting, that kind of certification thing requirement also arguably puts more, not more, but it kind of says, okay, you as a submitter, we're relying on you to certify that you complied, and so it kind of puts a little bit more of reliance on this on the person submitting the invoice at that point, which all seems beneficial to the government. But why they don't have them on all invoices, I'm not sure. Shane, I don't know if you have any thoughts on that.
Yeah, so at least I know in some cases courts have found that certifications like that say, you know, I certify that I've adhered to all the contract terms and all the applicable statutes and regulations. I know at least some courts have said that's too general to trigger False Claims Act liability. And I can't remember off the top of my head which courts have done that. But I know that at least in some circumstances that they've said that's a little too much. You know, if one toilet is in the wrong place on an aircraft carrier, it's not like every claim for payment for, you know, an aircraft carrier becomes false. And I think I think that's an area where practice could easily change following this this decision. So depending on how the court describes, you know, which certifications can be false and how, and you know what that looks like, I think you could see a huge change in government contracting practice. You know, along the lines that you said, that could kind of shift the landscape.
Thank you. That's all I have.
We do have time for some more questions. We don't have any questions pending. We've got about 10 minutes. If you have a question, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. And while we're waiting to see if we have a final question, let me ask a question. It might be naive. It might not. I don't know. But when I was in law school, we learned in criminal law a lot about the rule of lenity. And I'm wondering how that applies and whether the various circuit courts that have found this implied certification theory of liability, if they address the rule of lenity, and do courts take a different view of the rule of lenity when QI-TAM is involved. That is, when a private citizen can bring the force of sort of a criminal proceeding, or is QI-TAM criminal or not?
This is Shane. I think so. You've hit upon kind of another interesting fault line in the False Claims Act. So it is a civil statute, and there has been a lot of discussion about whether or not it is punitive enough that it should be considered criminal. And my understanding is that the rule of lenity only applies in the criminal context. And so courts have said, you know, that doesn't apply to the Civil False Claims Act, despite the fact that there's, you know, treble damages and penalties for false claims. I know there was at least one case, I think, in the Seventh Circuit where there was a really high number of claims that were submitted, but there was very low damages to the government. So it was like $1 or $2 million damages for in the case. But then there was like $30 million in fines because there were just so many small claims for payment that had been submitted. And I believe the Seventh Circuit said that's not an excessive fine because it's not a criminal statute. It's not punitive. Purely, it's designed to recoup the full cost to the government. And, you know, rooting out government fraud is very difficult. And so, you know, treble damages is not criminal, even though it seems very high and draconian for the civil context. And I don't know if you have any more thoughts on that, Steve.
No, I think you pretty much covered it there, Shane. I was just going to say I didn't think that was a naive question. That was a very good question. I thought Shane did a good job responding.
Well, let me make a final call for questions. If you have a question, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. Our lines are open. Well, gentlemen, we're not going to get that final question, or we've already had our final question, it would seem. Let me give each of you, since we've got almost 10 minutes left, a chance just to wrap up or express a final thought if you'd like to, and I'll leave it to you to decide who ought to go first in that exercise.
Shane, you want to kick us off?
Sure, absolutely. Well, I think just reiterating that this is a pretty significant case is important because I think this isn't a statute that, might be in the headlines very often for most people, but it is absolutely, you know, imperative for, $1 trillion of the economy because it's every government contractor, everyone who participates in Medicare and Medicaid. And the recoveries by the Department of Justice are, I think $3 to $6 billion each year at this point. And so a great expansion of potential liability under the False Claims Act would make, you know, compliance headaches for a huge portion of the economy. And, you know, contrary to that, you know, if they're too restrictive, you know, it could mean that fraud, waste, and abuse are, you know, not being rooted out in a huge area of the economy. And so I think just the sheer magnitude of the effects of this decision are hard to overstate, despite the fact that it seems a little bit technical and obscure, and it's, you know, one element of this specific statute. And I don't know if you have any more thoughts, Steve.
Yeah, and I think that's a really good point. I mean, I don't want to kind of speak ad nauseum about what a broad interpretation of the act its kind of effects on defendants. But I think it's one of these kind of interesting situations where the federal government, becomes more expansive, gets involved in more things, contracts out more with certainly as healthcare expands, and then also as it contracts out for more goods and services, this statute is just going to keep getting more and more important. And a ruling like this that really helps define or will ultimately define its scope and will in many ways say, what is fraud. I guess it goes back to what Shane said. It's an important case, and it's going to keep getting more and more important. The federal government expands into our lives, and again, despite its technical nature, it's going to have kind of broad ramifications.
Well, gentlemen, I thank you both for taking the time today to visit with us. I thought it's been a very, very interesting discussion, and perhaps we can have you back at a later stage when we've got more information on this. To our audience, thank you as well for joining us, and a reminder to join us for our next scheduled Teleforum conference call. That's tomorrow at 1 p.m. when we'll be discussing telecommunications transactions and the public interest. But until that next call, we are adjourned. Thank you very much, everyone.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at fedsoc.org/multimedia.